giant of limitless power at man's command. And where was it science found that giant? In the atom, a particle so infinitely small that it takes over 100 billion atoms to make up the head of a pin.
This is Out of the Basement, a podcast dedicated to radiation medicine.
This is Dr. Jason Vector coming at you out of the Vermont mountain basements here in a time of the year where we are going between spring and winter and getting 2 feet of snow, and then it's 55 degrees outside. And I am confused about that, but I am not confused about low-dose radiotherapy for osteoarthritis here on the Extrol-sponsored miniseries. This is episode 2. It better not be part 1 of more than one, so I'm just going to say episode 2. And this is going to be the getting started episode, as in, how do you get your first patients, and once you got them, what do you do with them? By way of overview here, we're going to hit some talking points in terms of laboratory and preclinical evidence. As a real zoomed out overview, this is one, by popular demand, but two, it helps in talking to referring clinicians and people in your office and patients, and we'll hit it more in depth towards the final episode there. We'll talk about where to get your first patients and let's call it advertising or referral streams. Mostly just when people think about doing this, they always want to do the same thing in terms of who to talk to for how to get patients. And I'll tell you right now, don't do it. Don't do what you think you want to do. We'll talk about that. Then bread and butter will go with setups, target volumes, prescriptions, and follow-up schedules. And we will be focusing on the good old LINAC, the linear accelerator, because while this episode and this mini-series is brought to you in part by Extrol, maker of fine orthovoltage devices across the globe, the people who are in America right now, I'm recording this in early 2024. If you're in America using an orthovoltage machine for arthritis, you don't need me to tell you how to do it. You probably know more than me. So we're going to stick with the LINAC. But on that note, yes, there are people using orthovoltage devices for arthritis and other benign conditions in America. It's a lot easier than you think, especially with a Extrol device. And insurance will definitely reimburse you, and you should go to their website and at least watch their fun YouTube videos, which I like to do because obviously I am a tremendous nerd. I made slides to go along with this that I will upload as a PDF and should be in the description of wherever you are listening to this episode. And if you can't find it, just shoot me an email at jason@coldlight.org, or find me on Twitter, or half of you have my phone number anyway, or can easily find somebody who does. So let me know if I mess something up. But in terms of a zoomed out overview of mechanisms of action, so I consider LDRT as in the same family of corticosteroids or NSAIDs. And while we have about 125 years of more or less clinical evidence for the efficacy of this, the lab-based evidence was a little bit slower to catch up, although there are things going back. I actually don't know when you can see your first sort of in vitro LDRT stuff. I think it's honestly back in like the 40s or 50s again, but it obviously showed up a little bit later than when people were just hucking patients in front of machines in 1906 and beam on. My favorite paper out right now is from 2023 with the senior author Lisa DeLock, and it's low-dose radiotherapy of osteoarthritis from biological findings to clinical effects challenges for future studies. And as always, this is predominantly a German-based paper, and they go through pretty comprehensively and very understandably. It's very well written and very easy to read and follow the mechanism. So it really hits two big points, as one, comparing 0.5 gray to 1 gray. I personally deeply believe, based on evidence and experience and whatnot, that 0.5 or maybe lower, but that's a future episode thing, but 0.5 gray is vastly superior to 1 gray, and the laboratory evidence bears that out, not just the clinical. And so this paper breaks down that to a degree, but I think about LDRT as altering the inflammatory environment on a molecular and cellular signaling level to a degree. So the big ones for why this works at 0.5 gray a day or per treatment is you decrease leukocyte adhesion, you increase in the osteoblast mineralization, viability, proliferation, you decrease osteoclastic differentiation and resorptive activity. And interestingly, and I always bring this one up when I talk to people because I think it's fascinating, that you can increase fracture healing. So the best one I know of this, or best paper, is a 2014, I believe, paper that used rats, and they compared fracture healing in rats exposed to LDRT and not, and there was like drastically significantly increased fracture healing in the treated rats. Now, would I ever suggest this as a ancillary treatment to casting if you're out on the playground and you trip and fall and break your arm and need a cast? No, at least not yet, maybe in 2035, but it's just a great illustration of how this all works. And so you really see in endothelial cells, this modulation of secreted cytokines, the pro-inflammatory cytokines, you decrease, again, the attachment of the leukocytes and you get reduced levels of reactive oxygen species. And the leukocytes themselves, you get hampered attachment to endothelial cells. So it's two sides of the same coin. So you reduce the stickiness of the endothelial cells, the leukocytes sticking to them, and you reduce the leukocyte stickiness and them sticking on their endothelial cells, which is a really awkward way to say that, but I'm not a poet. And you have, and I love this from this paper, the anti-inflammatory modulation of the cytokine milieu and increased rates of apoptosis. But I would strongly recommend checking out that paper, and I put the little citation in the slide deck with that, but really it's anti-inflammatory in a different way. And I have a figure here, it's slide number 4, of comparing and contrasting NSAIDs, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, corticosteroids, and LDRT. And so for mechanism of action for NSAIDs, you obviously have the inhibition of the cyclooxygenase enzymes, which reduce prostaglandins and obviously play a pivotal role in inflammation and pain. So it's a non-specific action with the COX-1 and COX-2 enzymes. With corticosteroids, those generally work by inhibiting phospholipase A2, which is also blocking production of inflammatory mediators, but more upstream of the inflammatory cascade than the NSAIDs. And so you get a broader suppression of inflammation and immune response. And LDRT modulates inflammatory processes, plural, at a cellular and molecular level, affecting the expression of inflammatory and anti-inflammatory cytokines and reducing leukocyte adhesion to endothelial cells. And it's more of a way to think of it as it's altering the cellular environment rather than just inhibiting specific inflammatory pathways. And for applications, which are all very familiar with NSAIDs, we use it for everything all of the time. It's over the counter. And with steroids, it's for more severe inflammatory and autoimmune conditions where you need the big guns. My favorite, as I hope yours is too, is dexamethasone. And LDRT is used for these kind of inflammatory degenerative disorders like arthritis and tendinopathies. And it's like how you think about why we'd use radiation for cancer is that you can get local effects with minimal systemic side effects. And in this case, minimal side effects in general, but it's a local treatment, whereas the systemic treatments come with systemic issues. And so the side effect profiles, I hope we're all familiar with NSAIDs, of GI issues like ulcers and bleedings and issues with renal function and cardiovascular risk. And same with steroids, which are the sharpest double-edged sword we have in medicine, of weight gain and osteoporosis and diabetes and agitation and lack of sleep and so on and so forth. And whereas with LDRT, you have a very low risk of side effects in general, and certainly not really systemic. Again, really hard to explain it this way. The only time I've actually seen a truly directly potentially related side effect to this is I was treating a woman's hand here in the Northeast in the wintertime, and towards the end, she told me that she thought her hands were more chapped than they normally get. She normally would get chapped hands in the winter. It gets dry up here, and she felt like they were more chapped than normal. That is honestly the only thing I have seen this far, except, and I say this for even the cancer patients, I do believe the side effect of time, the time commitment to just coming here, and the discomfort of being on that table. If you're 85 with joint issues and mobility issues and stuff, and even just briefly getting on the table for those six times can be uncomfortable. So that's always there no matter what. But any radiation above a threshold is theoretically put you at risk compared to if you had not gotten radiation above that threshold. But it's not like you're going to see the side effects with 10 days of dexamethasone. So I'm going to reveal my greatest analogy that I use for this, that I use in every single consult. I'm going to do this at the low, low price of free, where most people would sell their secrets, but not me. And in the spirit of trying to bring back eponyms in medicine, I'm going to call this Becht's beam analogy, because I wanted something like Simone's Maxims. But one day, when I was a kid, actually, one of my life goals was to discover a new bacteria and name it after myself. That ship has probably sailed, unless I retire from radiation oncology and decide to just become a full-time archaeologist, microbiologist. We'll see. So my spiel about this to patients and friends and family and colleagues and really anyone I can trick into listening to me yammer is to ask, how do we contextualize LDRT when all we know in America is radiation oncology, is the use of radiation to kill cancer cells? And that's how I think of conventional or oncologic doses of radiotherapy. So we call, often there's surgeries, but then there's oncologic surgeries. And there's no difference here either, where there's the oncologic doses of radiation that are meant to obliterate cancer cells. And those are the 60, 70 grays of the world. And we're not trying to do that here. LDRT is not meant to kill. It's meant to alter the cellular signaling, the cellular microenvironment. And I clearly, if you guys know me or listen to this, I love analogies and I love hokey sayings. And so one of my favorite hokey sayings is the difference between medicine and poison is the dose. And the analogy here is, if you think about dose in terms of radiation, dose is speed, as in miles per hour, because we're Americans, or whatever you non-Americans use, kilometers per hour, maybe. Dose is speed. And LDRT is like a bike. And conventional oncologic radiotherapy is like an airplane. So both airplanes and bicycles, they get you from start to finish. They're modes, they're mechanisms of transportation, but they're used for very different travel plans. And they work at very different levels of speed. And you can't get a plane to fly at the speed of a bike. And you would destroy your bike if you drove it at the speed of a plane. And that's this. That's everything there is to this. And I don't know if there's just some sort of mental block for people here, for the skeptics with LDRT, the thing that has been in use for almost 125 years, that this is the thing we're skeptical about. But as I talk about all the time, we know why that is. But this also reminds me of hearing Becht's beam analogy. There's a XKCD comic that I remember. God, this is so old now. I think this came out when I was doing my PhD. I don't know, but it always comes to my mind. And in the slides, I have this image, and it's a picture of the XKCD stick figure guy pointing a handgun at a petri dish next to a microscope. And caption reads, "When you see a claim that a common drug or vitamin kills cancer cells in a petri dish, keep in mind, so does a handgun." And also in the slides, I have a picture of a beautiful 1911 handgun with 70 gray underneath it, because I'm hilarious. A hilarious boy. So that's really how to think of this, is that, yeah, we're using radiation, but radiation is speed. You have airplanes use speed, bikes use speed. We use different speeds. So let's say I've convinced you, or any of the now increasingly visible voices out there using this have convinced you, and you want to start doing this, but it is uncomfortable to do something new, to stick your neck out. Believe me, I think it's obvious at this point that I say that from experience. There is a tendency, and this is what I was talking about at the beginning of don't do the thing you think you want to do. The incredibly common first reaction to, let's get going with this, is to say, let's set up a meeting with orthopedic surgery. You guys all do that. Don't do that. Now, no, nothing against our friends in orthopedic surgery. That was when I was in medical school. There's three things on my list of things I wanted to be when I grew up. One was radiation oncology, which is obviously what I did. Two was orthopedic surgery, and three was emergency medicine. I love orthopedic surgery more than I can tell you, which is actually hilariously ironic. And I'm just thinking about this out loud as I record this, given what I'm doing right now. But I love that stuff. That was a super fun time in med school. And that's the only time I've ever been yelled at for not hitting an open surgical field hard enough with a hammer. Anyway, I'll get off track. In American healthcare, joint replacement surgeries are one of, if not the most common and lucrative thing that we have other than Keytruda. And if you go and look at, so a lot of states either have, they're required to post the salaries of state employees, or some states, just like Vermont is one, is required to post the salaries of the top 10 highest paid people in certain industries and whatnot. And anyway, the salaries for orthopedic surgeons are true. They make a lot of money. And that's still true to this day. Unlike radiation oncology, I'm looking at you, Washington Post article and people who quote it. But how does that happen? How do they make so much money? And they're again, they earn that money. They deserve it. And in my opinion, none of us make enough money. All of our salaries should be doubled. If you don't agree with me, come at me. Seriously, I will debate this till the end of time, but I'm going to cut that short here. If you show up in a meeting with your orthopedic surgery colleagues and you say, hey, friends, I want to start doing this thing where we use low-dose radiation to alleviate the pain of arthritis and delay the need for consideration of joint replacement surgery. That is the same as, I don't know, a professional society authoring guidelines recommending hypofractor omission for the two most common indications for radiotherapy. That's going to significantly hurt the revenue stream of that specialty. They're not going to like it. And now that's not universally true, because again, I'm assuming patients are going to hear this too. And joint replacement is one of the greatest inventions of modern medicine. We all know people who have it. There's basically a pretty good chance that I'm going to have one. I don't know what or when or how or why, but I will be getting a joint replacement surgery. So will my wife. So will, well, her father has already had two. So that's why I get into this. But I've had back surgery. There's a reason I almost went into orthopedic surgery. I think that what they do is fundamental to quality of life. But when you take an industry, which is what healthcare is, American or not, and you have something that's been in place for decades. So the revenue streams, that's like a fundamental underpinning of many hospitals. And I love LDRT, obviously, but even I don't think that it replaces the need for joint replacement surgery. I wish it were that good in a sense, but it simply does not. And so the way I think about, like, why would we do this if it doesn't stop it? Well, so let's say you have somebody coming in with really severe knee pain that really disrupts their quality of life, and they've tried conservative measures of NSAIDs and physical therapy and corticosteroid injections and stuff, and the pain just is not relenting. And they're at that point where they say, the surgeons or whoever they're working with says, I think it's time for the joint replacement. That's when LDRT is perfect, because it is a low risk, reasonably high probability of providing that person with relief for a reasonable amount of time. So again, in my experience, at least 6 months, 12 months, it's hard. It's all going to be anecdote when I say this, but usually for the people that it works for, it's at least 6 to 12 months. And that's the first round. And so you can really buy someone, maybe depending on the pathology behind the osteoarthritis or the degenerative skeletal inflammatory condition, is minimum 6 to 12 months. And again, totally anecdote. Don't quote me on that. Or you can quote me on that as long as you say Becker says it's anecdote. But, and then they're going to have that surgery anyway. But the risk profile of a joint replacement versus LDRT, they're not even on the same planet. And if you can delay putting someone at the risk of side effects from your surgery for another year or two, that's buying them a year or two of quality of life that they didn't have before that was an option. And that's how I think LDRT needs to be measured in terms of endpoint. It's reduction in things like NSAID or narcotic use. It's delay in time to surgery and the complications thereof. It's improvement in quality of life. It's not a cure for arthritis or any of the inflammatory conditions. I wish it was, but it's simply not. That's not how life works. It's just another tool. It's like steroid injections. But for any of us who have lived in the real world, these systems level solutions are not well received. And clearly most of my time with my public facing content is arguing with various regulatory bodies and professional societies about systems levels, problems and solutions. And we don't live in a meritocracy. I have talked to my orthopedic surgery colleagues about this, but I've never tried to have a meeting or work with them on this, or it's always going to be a dead end. I know of, I'm thinking off the top of my head, one of my friends has gotten, works at a place with interested orthopedic surgeons and has had a successful collaboration with them. Most people, the meetings never really happen, or the surgeons aren't very interested, and they might just not understand it because, again, radiation is a mystery and it's scary. And even it's highly likely, actually, that you won't even get to the point where the economics of the situation is considered. It's just people are scared of radiation and it's a non-starter. Don't do that, or do whatever you want to do. But when it blows up in your face, just, I hope you hear my voice saying, I told you so. So how did I get my first patients? How did I start doing this? And for me, it was just from my own follow-ups, and specifically for two reasons. One, our patient population skews older, and the more years on this earth that you have lived, the higher likelihood that you have painful joints. And some of us, unfortunately, get painful joints earlier on, or some of us, like me, I had back surgery in my 20s. It's a human condition. It's very common. So I am not interested at this point in my career of being the primary diagnoser of things like osteoarthritis. And so I'm just going to keep saying osteoarthritis. Please mentally note that many other inflammatory degenerative conditions, but we'll say arthritis. So that's not my role right now. I'm a solo rural rat on, because I'm fond of saying cancer is my main focus and needs to remain my main focus. And so I don't have the bandwidth to do that. And so in my follow-ups, I will look and see if they have a pre-existing diagnosis of arthritis, which, spoiler alert, 80% of them do, and I'm sure yours do too. And I basically see if it comes up naturally, because if you ask people, I love open-ended questions that get drilled into my head as a med student. And it's pretty common when I will see how people are doing after radiation and kind of ask if they have any symptoms or problems or anything, blah, blah, blah. And so in the course of conversation, it will often come up organically that they have painful joints or whatnot. And if it is appropriate in the situation and in the conversation, I will bring up low-dose radiation for arthritis. I don't recall a time. I've never forced it. I've never really been aggressive about it. Simply, again, it bandwidth. And the reason I do it, yeah, point one is they're older and they will very likely have a pre-existing diagnosis of arthritis. Number two, they already know what radiation is. So if you think about all of our consults, so our new patient consults with the cancer patients especially, the majority of them have no idea what radiation is and they are terrified. So not only do they have cancer, they are now having to see this weird doctor they have never heard of. And this doctor is proposing radiation on them, and they only know of radiation as the atomic bomb or Chernobyl, and the nerves on that are out of this world. And then anyone who has seen or had radiation therapy knows it's pretty boring, which is part of why I got into this. I think it's fascinating. I love the fact that you can have this insane Star Trek sounding thing that cures cancer, and it sounds wild. And then when you see it, it's literally just holding still in a darkened room while a machine whirls around you and nothing seems to happen. That is crazy to me, and I love it. The follow-ups know this. So unless you had like a head and neck, or so in the modern era, the breast patients are a great example. If you have a hypofrac or APPI breast who was on top of the skin care regimen, it's probable they basically had no side effects. And are very minor, like dermatitis, basically. So they think radiation, they know what it is. They know what it is better than me. I've never been on the other end of a line. I assume I will at some point, but not yet. And so you've already circumvented that huge hurdle. And so that's how I always get started. So that's how I got started when I was practicing in New York. And that's how I got started when I came over here to Vermont. And the other thing you quickly realize is how crappy, and I want to use a very different words for that, but I'm going to mark this as I don't have explicit content when I upload this podcast, how crappy the treatments are for arthritis. So there are two more things. So those are the first two for why I like to talk to follow-ups. And then the two points for what you quickly realize is, one, the treatments we have for arthritis in modern medicine are awful. They are awful. Most of the time, they only work temporarily, if they work at all. And especially with our patient population, you'll get people who are not safe for joint replacement surgery. So you'll have a lot of these like 85-year-old people with multiple medical comorbidities, and the surgeons very appropriately say that surgery is too risky. This is not an option for you. Do that a lot. And people, if you offer them a new treatment, even if it had like tremendous risk, I think people would jump at it. That is my honest. They don't really even care. I could tell them that if it's a follow-up with a breast who had very minimal side effects, I could tell them, like, hey, you'll probably have some more skin reactions than you did. They would still do it. I think a lot of us who are younger, who don't have these chronic conditions, we underestimate how debilitating this is and how awful it is. And I have seen people like literally lean forward, almost like get out of their chair if I offer that. It's pretty wild. And it has made me really bummed out about medicine, even though I'm clearly bummed out about medicine a lot of the time. But so that's number one. And number two is we drastically underestimate the number of people in this country who have arthritis. So we're really skewed by our patient population is cancer, and cancer is common in a sense, but in an absolute sense, it is only a small segment of the population. So if you think about what even 250,000 Americans are diagnosed each year with breast cancer. All right, this country is what, up to we're 300-400 million people now? Well, it's nothing. Minimum arthritis. We're talking about 30-40-50 million people just in America. And that's just the diagnosis of arthritis. In each of those 30-40-50 million people, you're going to have more than one joint usually. I can only think about a handful of people where it's been, they've only wanted me to treat one joint. It definitely happens, but the majority of people have more than one joint. So if you're thinking about 30, 40, 50 million people with 1, 2, 3, 4 joints that are painful, it's overwhelming. And so I have personally capped the consults I'm willing to do per month or per week on this, because again, rural black cancer is the focus. And so I've asked to keep it to no more than 3 per week. And because what you'll see if you do this, and this is why I don't advertise, I don't practice build, I don't anything, I get word of mouth people. So I have told the staff, like, look, there's a belief that you can only see specialists still with a referral. That might be a geography thing, but for the most part, especially for our specialty, people don't need to be referred to us. They can make their own appointments and check your local sort of regulations on that. But what I tell people, because they'll see me and follow up with, oh, my friend, my brother, my mother, my whatever, really can't believe this and really wants to do it. How can they come talk to you? And I tell them the truth, which is just, here's my card. Tell them to call. Tell them I said to call and said that they want to have a consult for arthritis, and they just get on the schedule. And so that's what I do now, is that I have treated, once you treat a critical mass, which is less than you think. So I would say once you get through your first 6-12 patients, maybe less, depending on your community, and enough time passes. So it's the first 6-12 patients, first 6-12 months. Once you get to that year point and enough kind of word of mouth has happened, you'll just get people calling in. And especially if you treat staff. So once you start treating nurses and they talk to each other, and you'll just have staff show up. So that's honestly how I do it. So I've always done it. And that's why I also deeply believe this is real. All the evidence aside, that would not be the case. I wouldn't have people talking their husband or wife or mother into coming to do this if it didn't work for them too. And maybe it's placebo. I don't know. If it's placebo, it's people seem really happy for the most amazing placebo ever. It could be. I don't even be glib about that. But if I can just continue on with increasing volume, simply word of mouth, it seems like there's something to that. Don't talk to the orthopedic surgeons, but much love to our orthopedic surgery colleagues. All right. So you've successfully got someone to agree to your first LDRT experience. And what do you do then? What's your setup? What's your target volumes? Number one, please don't overthink this. That's number one, two, and three. People really go on and overthink this. And so in the slides here, I would recommend taking a look at a paper from 2021 out of Spain with the first author, Alvarez. And it is Radiotherapy CT-Based Contouring Atlas for Non-Malignant Skeletal and Soft Tissue Disorders, a Practical Proposal from Spanish Experience. And so that, to my knowledge, is the first Atlas contouring-based sort of setup publication that exists. It's wonderful. And these authors are wonderful. And it's amazing. Insert 10 more adjectives here. And it's a good starting point. Now, most of the time, you can treat most joints with a simple sort of supine, arms at the side, arms crossed deal. Don't overthink it. There are a few situations that I would specifically highlight. Point one is I will often tell the therapist to do what they think is best, because it's like going to a barber being like, oh, I should have XYZ haircut, and you don't know that looks crappy on you, but the barber is going to know it. But if you just say, hey, like, person who does this all the time, what do you think would work best? If there's something weird or quirky, I will let the therapist drive the ship because they're the ones who have to set it up every day and whatnot. And so they've actually, by doing that, I've learned some pretty cool tricks and things and watched them do various setups that we use a lot now. But so number one is don't force things, because again, there's no real wrong way to do it other than missing. So for hands, and this is the pictures I've included in the slide deck here, is a common one I do and a lot of us do is to do it prone and have the hands extended, the arms extended a bit with the fingers extended and under an Aquaplast mask for stabilization. I like this setup. It allows you to treat both hands and it's comfortable for the patients. I once had a person nearly fall asleep because they just, once you get on that slanted pillow that I think we all have, and yeah, hands prone on a cushion extended with under an Aquaplast mask. Don't be afraid to use a vac lock, which, well, I guess if residents or people who have always been at one institution, there's a lot of opinions out there on vac locks and things, which is for another time. But I like to use, for knees, I'll do like, we have those preformed knee cushions, but you can use a vac lock, and that's the picture the Spanish have here. But I really like a vac lock for feet. So what I like to do for feet is like a frog leg position, but with the legs flat on the table, if a patient can tolerate that, is it's a little bit of a stretching motion. And that allows me to do sort of an APPA beam arrangement without having to go through the entire foot, which is not the end of it. I would definitely go through the entire foot if it came down to it with the hesitation. But that's really the main message, is don't overthink it. And number one and number two, in terms of common questions, no, I do not block the fingernail specifically. You can, but that's way overkill. Remember, you're doing 3 gray here, and this is not going to 66 grays. It's not sarcoma. So I don't go out of my way to do a fingernail block. Now, that being said, most of the times, the way I identify the target volumes is a patient can say, oh, I have hand arthritis. There's a lot of bones in the hand. There's a lot of joints in the hand. So I always have them try to tell me where the pain is the highest, and I try to make sure that my targets are in that region. So I am often not treating the fingernails, but I also don't sweat it. And I don't know why I made that number one. That should have been number two, because the number one thing is, you do not need to spare a strip of skin. This is not sarcoma. You are not going to cause lymphedema, okay? Never do that. Never do that. And just really, it's important to keep in mind for all of this that airplane, bike, yes, it's radiation, but we're doing different things at different doses. 3 gray is not 70 gray. Seems silly to say that, but a lot of these, if you really zoom out and think about what is driving these questions, it is a fundamental sort of, not even misunderstanding, but mental block in considering the differences and effects of 70 gray versus 3 gray. You're not going to take the same precautions with an airplane that you would with a bicycle. And so in terms of target volumes, that's number one, is asking the patients where it hurts worse. Because as we all know, it can be hard when somebody will come in and be like, oh, my knee hurts. Well, knee is a bad example, but the hand's a good one. So, oh, my hand hurts. And you say, where? And so sometimes it's the thumb joint. Sometimes it's the center of the palm. Sometimes it's, that should be your focal point, because in complicated areas or areas with lots of pain points or whatnot, that can help guide your decision-making process. And so in the Alvarez Atlas paper here, they give a lot of examples of CTVs based on joints, and it's lovely. I think my personal only critique here is that I think they're small. These are CTVs, not PTVs. So I find them a little bit smaller than what I would do, but I view this paper as more of a helpful guideline, because radonks are not, we don't have to know about joint capsules and things necessarily, I think, unless you're one of the 10 sarcoma people on this planet. But it is a good reminder if you are 10 years out of anatomy about the joint capsule on the elbow, right? That's not part of our normal sort of repertoire. It's not a retrospective SEER database study from 1999 that you had to memorize the p-value on for boards. I included, I think, the majority of the images from their paper, just as examples. Again, this paper is incredible. Read it, download it, pass it around, cite it, follow the authors when they publish other things. It's great. And it's a good starter point, because there's no real wrong way to do this. What should guide you is listening to the patient, where their pain is, understanding in general, broad strokes, the anatomy of the region, and setting them up in a way that allows you to target that effectively. And then the number one most important thing is don't skimp. Big fields. I can't say it enough. Do not be cute. And so I included one of my favorite papers that drove my practice patterns a lot, is The Field Size Matters, Low Dose External Beam Radiotherapy for Thumb Carpometacarpal Osteoarthritis. And they actually compared field sizes and found that the bigger field sizes had significantly better results. And that tracks. So if you think about from the lab evidence, so from the in vitro, from the in vivo evidence, it is about altering the cellular microenvironment. And when you have inflammation in a joint space, it's a cascade. So you have inflammatory signaling, inflammatory cells talking to each other, and then that just starts, it doesn't stay localized. We all know this. There's a reason when you have swelling, when you have edema from injury or pain, it is not small in general, right? It's, and so the cells is a concert. It's an entire environment. And if your mechanism, if your treatment is altering the environment, you need to make sure you hit all that environment. Now, NSAIDs or oral steroids, they're systemic. So they do this by default. There's no way to, the equivalent would be not giving a high enough dose of dexamethasone is the equivalent to small field size. Don't do that. You would never, if you have a malignant cord compression, you're not going to start somebody on 0.5 mg of dex BID. You're going to do the protocol. That's what this is. This small field sizes are 0.5 mg of dex for cord compression. Don't do it. And it does feel awkward because, again, this is going against what we're dogmatically taught, where if you have a sarcoma of a joint or like the lower extremity, you are taking it to a really high dose, 60 something gray, right? And you got to worry about the strip of skin. And at that dose, if you're adjacent to certain things or whatnot, you have to be very cognizant because, again, you're flying an airplane and an airplane can really cause a lot of damage. But here, we're driving a bicycle, right? And big field sizes. And I included here, this is on slide number 18, a person I treated. Now, this person had really bad bilateral combo, like plantar fasciitis and osteoarthritis. And that's the other thing to remember is osteoarthritis is like a catch-all term to a degree because it's not necessarily the original disease where you can have inflammation of a joint space for multiple reasons. And so this person has like a long-standing, many-year history of like plantar fasciitis, arthritis, just painful inflammation problems in her feet, both feet. And she had tried many of the prior therapies, including, and I didn't even know this was really a thing that was commonly done until I really explored her history. There's like a lithotripsy type thing, like some sort of ultrasound-based treatment that the IR docs, I believe, will do to try to break up the scar tissue and the plantar fascia. It sounded horrific. And she'd even had that and it had worn off. So she had both bilateral arthritis, plantar fasciitis, and Achilles tendonitis. And so this is a good example of when I drew really big PTVs and had really big fields to cover both the plantar fascia and up the Achilles tendon. And it's just meant to, as a way to show both my favorite setup. I love doing the frog leg flat in a vac lock for the bilateral feet. And by doing that, you can get APPA beam arrangements and just big fields. And then I also quote a little bit more detail from that field size matter papers of the observed beneficial effect of larger treatment portals must have been independent from the effect of irradiation as a higher proportion of patients initially treated with smaller fields received a second treatment series. So then I have a couple slides on exactly what I'm talking about in terms of why this would work. Why does this field size matter? And it's about kind of the anatomical basis of arthritis and what happens. So when you have bone edema, which is what you'll see with inflammatory conditions of joints and bones in that area, it just cascades. It touches multiple things and those inflammatory cells all kind of communicate with each other. And Pathophys slide I took from a paper, actually it's from RSNA, and they're talking about using a knee EMBO for arthritis, which if the IR docs are doing EMBO for arthritis in the knee, you could do LDRT too. But so what do you get? Like, what is arthritis? It's mechanical forces resulting in degenerative changes, which get inflammation. Inflammation stimulates angiogenesis and vice versa. And then it results in pain and further degenerative chain. It's a whole feedback loop. And that's why the bigger fields are important. And then for the slide deck, just so people can reference this without having to listen to me yammer about stuff, is just really high level sort of general language at the level of more clinician type stuff of just mechanisms of inflammation spread from joints to tissues in relationship to pain. Because when you have the edema, you have direct activation of the receptors from the inflammation, but also the pressure and the stretching. And it's just this giant feedback loop that is much bigger than just the inciting sort of localized event. And finally, the other thing just to plug is the International Organization for Radiotherapy for Benign Conditions, the IORBC, which I am part of the advisory board for. And so This group is literally international. It's all the people who are really interested in driving the space forward, and including some of the German folks who have been very instrumental in a lot of the... fun fact, did you guys know that 20 years ago, there was an Astro refresher course section on benign radiotherapy, and Germans were there. We used to remember what this was, not even that long ago. But so if you go to IRBC, the website, irbc.com, it's been its infancy, but things have been really picking up speed, and it's truly an international collaboration. And one of the things that we've been talking about is basically this, is trying to pull from people who have a lot of experience, and can we refine target volumes? Can we provide resources for people to reference? Because getting up and going with kind of an entirely novel thing is intimidating. And there's we started doing a newsletter, and they mostly use LinkedIn because I know people have translated to that or transitioned to that a lot. And it's really big over more in Europe, but they're more active on LinkedIn than anywhere else. But I would really go check it out. And it's very helpful. Obviously, I'm biased being a part of it, but it's been really lovely to actually see the people who we talk about all the time when we read these papers and whatnot. But so the main point being is, don't overthink this, bike an airplane. And the next episode will be about coding and billing. And as a spoiler, it is covered by insurance. And the big one is that this is much cheaper to society than joint replacement in an aggregate sense, which we'll explore later. But again, in addition to go seeing the IRBC website, remember to check out Extral. And you can do this. You should do this. I'm going to do this to myself. It might be I do it to my wife before myself because her hand's worse, or worse than mine. But I will be throwing myself on the beam for this. And I would throw anyone I know or love under the beam. And if that's not good enough for you, then I don't even know why you're listening to this podcast. You probably want me to yell at professional societies about things, which I will. Don't worry. We'll get back to that. We'll get back to that. But for now, LDRT. Learn it, love it, live it.
This has been a Photon Media production. Don't forget to like and subscribe on whatever platform you use to listen to us. Be well and beam on.